from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this past September when the New York State Teacher of the Year was announced. And for Christopher Albrecht, it might have been a surprise. For those who know him best, it was not a surprise at all. This is a teacher, a fourth grade teacher at the Fred W. Hill School in Brockport, who has become known for not just teaching the subjects, but teaching the students, getting to know them personally, getting to understand them individually, and teaching in ways that reach kids very, very differently. Well, he's back with us today because we had a chance to talk to him, I think it was just a few months ago, or shortly after the announcement in September, and it was one of those hours that just felt like it flew by. We had so much to talk about with the Teacher of the Year. He has a chance now in this position to sort of, make an impact as Teacher of the Year and visit other schools and learn how they're doing things, maybe take some ideas there. So what we wanted to do was this. We wanted to come back and have a conversation about some of the themes that we didn't get to last time, including community service, teaching charity as part of student learning and what that looks like and why that's valuable. We want to talk about students that he has impacted. He brought with him Jacob Gaskill today, who's a graduate of SUNY ESF and a PhD student, somebody that we're going to get to know well this hour. By the way, welcome to you, Jacob. It's great to have you.
Thank you very much.
And we're going to talk about visiting schools, what Christopher Albrecht is seeing here in the Rochester area, across New York State. So welcome back here, Teacher of the Year. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you, Evan?
Good. You always seem like you're in such a good mood. Do you ever have down days?
I try not to. I think I think if you can put a smile on your face, put a smile on your face.
Well, the Teacher of the Year told us he wanted to bring Jacob Gaskill. So we'll talk to Jacob in a second. Why don't you introduce him as his former teacher and why you wanted to bring Jacob today?
Well, Jacob's a very inspirational story. He was in our classroom. I share a classroom with Amy Stoker, who's also a fourth grade teacher. We started 20 years together, or 20 years ago together in Brockport. We were hired 6 days apart. And in our third year, 2001, Jacob was in our class for fourth grade and then finished again in fifth grade. We used to loop back then. And Jacob was an average student in school. He had a love of sciences and mathematics. Pretty good reader, but in terms of writing, always just that was a little bit of a challenge for him. But one of the things that I always looked up to, and there's a reason why I brought him, because as a teacher, I looked up to Jacob. And, you know, you think of students looking up to their teachers, but I actually looked up to him as a student because he spent a lot of time always trying to make sure that his work was done well. And especially spelling was not his thing. And I think he can probably remember that spelling and not writing neatly, but he's living proof. He's living proof that years later now, you're 25 now, Jacob?
25.
25 years old, and he's out in Missouri working on algae blooms. And you want to tell him a little bit about what you're working on?
Yeah.
Yeah, I study harmful algal blooms and ways that we can try to mitigate those blooms and get the most out of our aquatic resources from a recreational standpoint, as well as human health and to a lesser degree animal health standpoint as well.
It's awesome.
Yeah, and you know, you kind of think back to, he was a 10-year-old, 11-year-old in my classroom, and we're just working on spelling. Now years later, just to be a teacher and know that he's working on such amazing projects right now and doing good for the world and doing things that I think are going to impact the world in a positive way, it just brings me a lot of pride. So that's why I asked if I could please bring a student or two onto the show, because he's one of many, many students. And it's not just out of my classroom. There's a lot of great stories out there of students and young people. I think we tend to have at least it seems to me like a very negative view of people in their 20s right now, but there's so many of them that are doing successful things right now and coming out of the classrooms and are trying to do good for the world, which is a very positive thing. Jacob's one of those people. You can tell by, you know, just even the way he talks right now that he's going to be doing great things for our world in terms of algae blooms and making the environment a better place. So that's great, Jacob.
Well, I want to ask Jacob how you think of your own elementary school self. Were you a good student? Were you a hardworking student who struggled? I mean, like, how would you characterize yourself in those days?
Yeah, I think my parents had a really big role in that. They were invested, and they were really good examples. And yeah, I think that I enjoyed school. It was a fun place to go, and because of that, then it makes it easier to put in the work and to be at the place and to want to do well, to want to people that support me to make them happy and make them proud. So yeah, because of that, I think I was able to work hard, and I enjoyed working hard. It was a good thing.
Do you have any teachers who stand out to you over the years?
Yeah, fourth and fifth grade, those were very, very good years. It was a very special place to be, and looking back, it's a great thing. You don't realize how lucky you are, I think, until you have some perspective. But
yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I John Thompson, wherever you are, he was the teacher that stands out to me that really, I didn't know it was happening at the time, but he was helping me see what excitement I could have about my own future and what it might look like. Why fourth and fifth grade? Why Mr. Albrecht standing out for you specifically?
I mean, it was fun. Science was really fun. We got to do hands-on experiments that I still remember some of them, and that stuck with me. I thought the team teaching with Mrs. Stoker was also really great. We had a bigger class size between the two classes, so we had a bigger group of people. But then at the same time, there was home base, so the different home rooms that broke it down, and it was also a smaller environment, so you didn't get lost in the shuffle. And then broke it down even to smaller groups and working on smaller groups. And because of that that setup, I think they were able to tailor the education to the learning level of the different students. And looking back on it, that was I think a big part of why it was such a good place to be. It was tailored learning.
What did you think when you found out he was Teacher of the Year?
It made me very happy. I think you hear a lot of times when people get they cut corners and they seem to get rewarded for that. So to have someone who doesn't cut corners and is doing the right thing, and for that to be recognized, I think that's a positive thing, and it gives me comfort, and it makes me happy that those qualities are recognized. I wasn't surprised, but it was a very happy thing.
Yeah. Well, Christopher Albrecht, one of the reasons I know you wanted to bring Jacob is because you think he does exemplify the potential that students have, especially when we don't just, you know, sort of narrowly define what makes a good student or what makes for potential in a student. So can you tell me a little bit more? You brought it up last time, and I want to talk a little bit more about the value in not necessarily what we teach, but how we teach.
Oh, my gosh. That's the nail on the head right there, is how we teach. Every child has potential, and I don't believe, no matter what the circumstance is, whether you're coming out of a very good situation. You know, Jacob mentioned his parents right there being strong influences on me, his wonderful parents. Any child has the potential to do well, not just in school, but in life. You know, the ultimate goal of school is not about doing well in school. It's about preparing us to be citizens in our world. And that focus right there is the most important thing. So when I talk about how we teach being much more important than what we teach, though each of us gravitates towards things, I happen to be a person that likes to write and to do science. Really, those things have to be set aside and really don't matter all that much then when it comes to how we teach. So the how we teach, communication is a huge part of it. A lot of students that I think struggle at school, or students that are doing well at school, the big defining factor is confidence and belief. And how do we teach that is a very large part of a successful classroom. So when we look at how we teach, Jacob and I were just talking about this over lunch. I might have a lesson. Being a fourth grade teacher, I spend half my day on the floor on the carpet with the kids and the other half of the day up at the seats. It's a transitional year between, you know, the elementary, very young elementary to that upper elementary. And I might say something, I might pose a question to a class, and there's a strategy called think, pair, share. So you think about the question and then you turn to a partner, talk to them about the answer, and then we open it up to the full group. But I can remember being a child and always having that anxiety, just like almost every child, where you think to yourself, oh my gosh, am I going to have a partner to talk to? And I think even as an adult, if you're at a conference and you're sitting next to somebody and say, okay, you're going to talk to the person next to you, and there's three of you there, you think, okay, one of us is not going to get a partner. And so what we do is we teach that piece where we say, okay, you're going to get a partner, but make sure you look behind you and beside you. And if you see someone that doesn't have a partner, please invite them into your group to be part of your discussion and just have a group of three then. So little things like that, I think, are so important. And that really leads into the philosophy of being servants to our world and teaching service, that service can't be relegated to just maybe a project where we go into town and clean up something, that it really needs to be an hourly minute, you know, every minute, every hour, every second, that we're conscious of the people around us. And that needs to be taught at the youngest of ages, starting in the home, and then in the earliest ages of preschool and early elementary, where we're very conscious of each other and helpful to each other. So the how we teach is so, so important. And what I've noticed is, as a result, I've been teaching now for 23 years, and as I've gotten adopted that even further and further in my classroom, my behaviors in class have reduced tremendously. We've got a classroom where by 40 days into school, it's not me saying turn to a neighbor and talk to them about it, but they're actually recognizing next to them the person that's next to them. And if the person next to them is successful and they're struggling, they will ask that child before they raise their hand and ask me, which is wonderful. It's becoming a community of learners then, as opposed to me being the all-knowing one, which a teacher's not supposed to be. A teacher's supposed to be a facilitator of learning, but not necessarily the one that, you know, just has all the knowledge. And so what happens is, if you keep that culture going, is students that need help are willing to ask and not be afraid to make a mistake and not be afraid to ask for help from another student. And likewise, the ones that are, you know, that are having success in that moment are willing to share that success with others. It just builds a great learning environment, like great learning community. And you don't see bad behavior. The bad behavior seem to extinguish as they start discovering that I'm part of something here. And I think that just becomes part of, I believe in myself. Like, each child feels that self-belief and self-confidence.
I don't think most schools, or even, I don't think it's fair to say, why do we categorize students? Because I think most of the time, at least in my experience, meeting teachers at all levels and school leaders at all levels, I don't think that they are actively trying to categorize every student, you know, good student, bad student, in between. But certainly we can at least relate to the people who've struggled, or will look back at their childhood and say, well, I was always told I wasn't good at science. I wasn't, or I'm just not a good reader, or I'm just not, whatever it is. And I guess I want to ask you why you think that still does happen then, given the fact of that, you know, you may be the teacher of the year, and if I were another teacher, if that was my profession, I would probably just go and study for a while to learn from you. But we know what is working and what is not really working. I think that we're getting more data. So why do we still kind of categorize students sometimes? Not to say it happens everywhere.
Well, but you kind of hit the nail on the head very, very well right there when you said data. We live in if I were to compare schools from the 1960s, 70s, and even into the 80s, I would consider education and being a teacher an art, and now teaching is becoming more of a science. So there's been a huge shift in education from art to science. So now, with the ability, I mean, whether we're in the digital era or anything, or whether we're looking at, I know Jacob and I were talking about earlier about, you know, you put a certain amount of money into something, you want to see results. And when you see gaps in learning, where you see lower test scores in certain areas or with certain students, you feel like you have an obligation to do something about it nowadays, because teaching has become very science oriented. So there's been that shift from science to, or from art to science. What to do about it? Well, you know, when you've got a child that's struggling in an area, like, let's say they're really struggling in mathematics and they need that extra help, bringing them in for extra time or giving them extra time in math, they're not fools. They know why they're getting extra time in math. Because they know they're not good at it. And I would tend to go a different direction, actually. And this is where I buck the system a little bit. It's not that that I'm belittling any school system at all, because I think for the majority, in fact, I haven't found a school yet that I wouldn't say is not trying. You can't fault schools right now. Schools are trying very, very hard to do the right thing. It's not about that. But the approach, the how, is something we really do need to look at. I would say that when a student has some type of talent, everybody has talent and everybody has weakness. We all do. I do. You do. It's not, being State Teacher of the Year doesn't mean that I'm the best teacher. There's certain things that I do very well, but there's some things that I'm not so good at as well. So when we look at that, what we need to do is we need to find what students are interested in. We need to find what they're good at, and we need to triple down on those things to help them build self-belief. And then we still need to revisit those things and get to at least a level of proficiency in those areas that they're not so strong in. But if we just constantly are pounding the gaps and pounding the areas that the data is showing that we're not doing well in, well, then you're taking an area we're struggling in and you're compounding it. And that's not going to build self-belief. It's not going to build courage. It's not going to build that feeling that if I make a mistake, I can still feel confidence. You build on no confidence, actually, by doing that. So I would say that the how we go about it is a very important part of how we solve this problem of remediation and, students that do struggle academically. Because students that – I have a boy right now in my class that you would say he struggles in every academic subject, but I'm willing to tell you that kid can take a dirt bike, assemble it, reassemble it better than most auto mechanics can. And if we could just celebrate those things right there and build that self-belief right there in that and then help transfer it to something else, that'd be great. I had a boy 2 years ago that has cerebral palsy. He couldn't run 100 yards, and he ran a 5K that same year after 5 months of training because he wants to become a police officer someday. We could have just shrugged our shoulders at that point and said, there's no way this kid can do it. But what we did is we tried to find what he was good at and then transfer it to the areas that he wasn't. And lo and behold, his state test scores went up as well. So, those things, building of self-belief and confidence, I think transfer across the board once you find it.
And that's so interesting because that really is the opposite. I mean, I had subjects I struggled with, and what happens? You get extra help, extra help, extra help. And what that ended up for me, and I'll ask Jacob if you felt the same way, I think back to some of the struggles I had in certain subjects. For me, it was like, well, you're going to have to get extra help here, and then just get through that with a decent grade, and then you're done with them forever. That was sort of the mentality, as opposed to what do you do well, what can we celebrate, and maybe you get pulled along in the other subjects as well, but you don't feel that stress. It doesn't knock down what you're doing with the rest of your day. How did you feel about, whatever it was that you struggled with?
Yeah, definitely. Statistics. It was just get through it and pass the test and then be done with it. And that's not lasting learning. That's not helpful. So I think that's entirely right. If you focus on the things that you're good at, that does definitely build the self-confidence, and then you're able to have that desire to branch out and maybe try to work on things that you're not as good at, because you do have that foundation and you are confident in certain areas. I agree entirely.
It makes so much sense to me, but it is not something I see often. Well, not a surprise it comes from Christopher Albrecht. My guest for the hour is the New York State Teacher of the Year, a fourth grade teacher at the Fred W. Hill School in Brockport. He was announced earlier this year as New York State's Teacher of the Year. And with him is Jacob Gaskill, a graduate of SUNY ESF, which is ESF is what?
The College of Environmental Science and Forestry.
And now working toward a PhD and doing great things. And so we've got a great chance to talk to a student and the New York State Teacher of the Year. And you mentioned service, community service, volunteerism. So I want to hit on how that's changing a little, but also how our guests view this issue in context of not turning it into broccoli, not turning it into piano lessons, because I now wish I had stayed with piano lessons, and I didn't. I now wish there are certain things I was a better eater of, and I just didn't listen early on. But I was told that I had to, and therefore I rebelled against it. Well, here are some numbers and some studies out there. Data collected by the Education Commission of the states. In 2001, only 7 states allowed high school credit for service. 19 states do at the latest. But A 2013 study of Maryland students said those requirements reduced, requiring students to volunteer, reduced volunteerism in later life. So here's what the study found. Before the requirement, Maryland seniors were 7.8 percentage points more likely than the national average students to be engaged in service activities, driven primarily by rising service activities among boys and following a national trend of more volunteering during that time. Well, then Maryland puts in this requirement. You got to do service. And what happens? Maryland seniors become 9.2 percentage points to almost up to 17 percentage points less likely than the national average to volunteer. Maybe because they thought, well, I already did it. I already had to do it. I got out of the way. I don't want to do this. And then it doesn't become part of the culture. So, Christopher, let me start with you, because as a fourth grade teacher, that's different than high school service. There's questions on what's too young. Is it too young? How do you instill that mindset? And how do you do it in a way that doesn't become the same thing that Jacob and I were just talking about? Hey, pass this stats test and you'll never have to do it again. Do this service volunteer project and you'll never have to do it again. How do you do it a different way and make it permanent? Is that a
100%, yes. I totally understand what you're asking. We've used service, and you're 100%. I'm not surprised by that. Is it Maryland you
Maryland,
were talking
yeah,
about?
It's Maryland.
Yeah, Maryland. Maryland has a great education system down there, so it's not. There's an example of a school district trying to do the right thing. They're not a bad school. There are very, very few schools out there that are terrible schools. They're trying. It's just not working sometimes. We don't always
find success. These are unintended consequences.
Right.
Absolutely.
Absolutely unintended. What I would encourage people to do is, we always talk about think locally or act locally, and local is the person sitting next to you. You know, that person, service starts with the person sitting next to you, the person that you're walking by. Service starts with the person that you're spending your day with. And when we look at community service projects, you know, we talk about projects, and there's a very strong difference between a project and a life of service. A life of service is what's in front of you at the moment. You know, you have a choice. You mentioned earlier that I always seem like I'm smiling. That's a form of service, actually, because it's a choice right there on how you act. But projects are important, too. We had this past fall on a Saturday, I threw out an email to my class. There's a great historical building, the Morgan Manning House in Brockport. I threw out an email. I knew it was going to be a sunny day. I knew they needed a lot of yard cleanup down there. And I had, I think, about 10 students and their families show up, and we cleared out garden beds and got a heck of a lot of work done. That's a project, though, and that is not a lasting and endearing thing. That's a one-time shot right there. It's something we might do traditionally each year, but I don't think, similar to Maryland, I don't think those things will produce a lifelong kind of culture of service. Whereas if we start focusing on, how do I serve within my classroom with the people that are right around me at that moment? What can I do to be charitable towards the person that I'm looking specifically at this moment? Those are the things that produce it. And that has to be woven into every lesson. And I could get very specific. We could go 5 hours talking about this right now. It needs to be woven into every lesson.
Even in fourth grade.
Even in preschool, you know, that when we walk down the hall, I'll give you a great example of something. When we have the Hill School, was built in 1990, and it has an upstairs and a downstairs. So we have to pass through two doorways. And of course, the place of greatest misbehavior when kids are walking down the hall would be the stairwell, because you're going downstairs, jumping downstairs, you've got railings, everything you can imagine. So what we do is, I have two line leaders that serve our class by being at the beginning of the line. But as kids are supposed to go, whereas kids go through the door, they say it's required in our class to say thank you. And they count up thank yous. And at the end of the week, we kind of celebrate the amount of thank yous that we got in the door. And eventually we say, thank you, Evan. So you actually say their name. So we're teaching that culture. What's neat is, about 40 days into school, I don't have to have a clipboard and tallying it. It's an automatic. Kids just do it automatically right there. And what we noticed as a classroom with Mrs. Stoker's class and mine is, our behaviors in the stairwell extinguish. We have very good kids going down they always go down the right-hand side of the stairs, because if another class is coming up, they can pass. And It's just those little daily small actions. We tend to look at service and community service as a very, very grandiose, large project-based things. When true service, if we look at, you know, even like a, you know, the ultimate examples of service, your Gandhis and your Mother Teresa's and people like that, they served on the individual level with the individual person, and they found the greatest success when they were working with those people. And I'm not saying our classroom's anywhere near that, but the model is very similar, that we're working with individuals, you know, and considering service to be an individual act of kindness.
Jacob, what do you remember about that aspect of learning when you were that age?
Yeah, when it is a requirement, as it was in certain years, even up through college, certain classes required it. It kind of turns into a box that has to be checked, and it turns into more of a chore almost. I think having those smaller things and looking at it locally, every day you're interacting with people. So if you can extend that and redefine what service is, maybe to include that, I think that would be a great strategy. And if it is a requirement, then people are going to look at it in a different light than if it's just a way of life sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I view very different. If you require me to go out and do one clean up a lot project, cool, okay. But that's a one-time thing, as you said, with the garden project. If you require me to say thank you every day, that may become a habit. It may become more involuntary and might even become something that I like doing. That's the thing. I mean, like, I don't know, if you can't make everybody like saying thank you or like, you know, being pleasant in interactions, but some people, right?
I would say I haven't come across a single child that doesn't embrace it. I would say by about November, I would say every child embraces it, and it's just part of it's just the way we are. And I have very few kids misbehave in my classroom, zero to none. The kids will challenge boundaries. Kids are kids. Kids will challenge boundaries and all that, but the practicing of it, like you said, it's repeated behavior, repeated daily, repeated hourly, repeated every minute. And once you repeat that enough, it becomes part of who you are. And it works.
And the goal then, as you said, is, you know, you're not just trying to teach subject matter. You're trying to you know, teach kids to become, you know, human beings. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so what is the long-term goal with that service component? Do you have one as a teacher?
Well, there's a lot of them. It's obviously the ultimate goal is to create citizenship that these children, as they grow, they're already active in our community. I've tried very, very hard over the past few years to activate the children in the community as much as possible, in the community, in my classroom as much as possible. But the ultimate goal is that on their own, someday, these children will be self-sufficient. They will be able to go out into the community, lead lives. And I'm not saying necessarily become doctors or lawyers, but become a productive citizen and be successful. And what I would define as successful is just pure happiness, that they live lives that they can say at the end of their lives, that was a good life. I'm glad. I have very little regret in my life, and that I actually accomplished something with my life to better this world. And it's not that we're trying to better the world and all become, you know, these great, you know, prophets or anything like that that are creating, you know, massive projects, but just living good lives. I think a lot of the things that we look at in the media right now, it's one of the biggest challenges is incorporating technology in the classroom, because immediately you bring up a homepage of MSN or Yahoo and there's a lot of negativity on there. If we're going to get away from this negativity, we need to bring in a very positive approach into our classrooms. I mean, childhood's the starting point. So it's let's get it off to the correct start.
Let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back to some of your phone calls and comments for the New York State Teacher of the Year, Christopher Albrecht, a fourth grade teacher at the Fred W. Hill School in Brockport. And joining him in studio is Jacob Gaskill, one of his former students, who's 25 years old now and doing wonderful things, and having a great conversation with Jacob and Christopher about the process of teaching and about a number of different things. So we'll come back to your phone calls next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the Next Connections, why are so many people upset about what's happening along the banks of the Erie Canal? The Canal Corporation will explain their plan for clearing the banks, and activists, homeowners, even bipartisan leaders of government will explain why they are opposed to it. Then in our second hour, James Norman is retiring, a conversation with the longtime leader of Action for a Better Community. Talk with you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, Bonnie in Rochester, first on the phones. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. Two things. One is on the discussion a minute ago about service. I think it was this last week there, the XXI presented a program on Finland, and, you know, they have a very high rating, for lack of a better word, mm-hmm. on their quality education. And they are, you know, trying to reach out to additional approach. And one of the things, the terms they use that I am just such a strong believer in, and that is the interdisciplinary kind of approach. And, you know, that's a longer discussion that we probably don't have time for, but it really so much involves all kinds of disciplines together. And the nature of that also includes not just the obvious pieces, but the, shall we say, the more underneath pieces like oppression. It incorporates all that. It doesn't just say, here's a course in oppression. So when you do that, when you play it out, what you find is that issue of service, or that issue of we're going to look at this particular situation, becomes almost natural. It doesn't have to have a label because this interdisciplinary approach really includes a lot of that. It doesn't separate it out. So that's really the other comment I want to make is I'm so glad that Jason is there, because one of the issues that I am always been concerned about, and I'm still concerned about, is that the more we get into technology, which has a lot of good things about it, the more we start dividing people up. And so it used to be, if you know, you may be okay in one subject, and you may be much better in another, because that's the way people are. And I'm worried that we're not going to do that as much, and that these testings and everything are leaning, have been leaning, and maybe continue to lean, in a direction that says, you better be really, really good at all your math. You better be really, really good in all your science. And if you're not, you're somehow not quite as worthy or valued. Mm-hmm. So that's my comment.
Yeah, Bonnie, thank you for that phone call. Let's work backwards there. And Christopher, when that just sort of echoes what we were saying earlier, the concern that, you know, we're not really emphasizing some of the strengths, and especially if the strengths, as you say, fall outside of a standard set of educational subjects, then we just tell students, you better fill in those gaps and we will drag you along, because mm-hmm. that's the goal. Pass these tests, get decent grades, do well on the standardized tests. Mm-hmm. So it seems to echo some of what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, Bonnie and I think, Bonnie, you and I share a very, very similar pedagogy right there. And I do appreciate your phone call. And first off, happy holidays. We should be greeting each other as we talk. You're echoing a lot of the sentiments that I have right now. I do think there is a place for standardized testing. And the last time I was on this show, it's funny, there's only two moments in this whole experience as State Teacher of the Year that I've stumbled. And one of them was on this show last time, and it involved state testing. And it got me to reflect quite a bit. I would say there is a place for state testing, and state testing has been around as far as I can remember, because I took it as a kid. It was the Stanford Achievement Test back in the 1970s. But what's happened is with the oncoming of a more scientific approach in education as opposed to an arts approach in education, we've become very diagnostic, and as a result, like you said, it can dominate a lot of the time that we have at school. The fact of the matter is, a school day is a very, very fast time period. I would give anything to have longer school days, just simply because I feel rushed oftentimes to get through the amount of curriculum that I'm required to get through. And for the sake of the children, oftentimes I have to triage it, because that shouldn't be that speed and that that pressure of getting everything done. The kids don't need to feel that. That's something I need to balance out right there. In terms of building a culture and building a way of service in our schools, I do believe that it can be done in all school districts and in all places right now. And you know, I, and for the most part, teachers, you know, I, people have different opinions of teachers and schools and all that, but I, you know, from an insider and from an outsider, I'm a father of three, and I live in the community that I teach in. Education, for the most part, they're trying. Teachers and schools are trying to do the right thing. It's not, we're not always doing the right thing, but we are trying to do the right thing. And, you know, we have to always remember that we learn from our mistakes over time. We're failures in life. There's no such thing as a failure in this world. The failure comes when we fail to recognize our mistakes. And schools are a place of, you know, that we try our hardest, but we do make mistakes and hopefully learn from those mistakes. The failing schools are the ones that are too stubborn to admit that, yes, this is going the wrong direction. We need to change. But the schools that are making mistakes on things, and that includes the way we respond to testing. Testing's only one very small part of the puzzle. It does give us a dipstick into kids, but the fact that it is blown way out of proportion right now. Testing is something every person cringes on. That, therefore, it's being very, it's just too publicized right now on testing. It should be just a small dipstick and part of the puzzle, along with teacher input, parent input, and other measures that we see, even just daily portfolios, that to really evaluate where a child's at in their learning, and then a course of action. One of the things that Bonnie mentioned right there is kind of diversification also, and I don't know if that's exactly the word she talked about, but we have a term in education called an IEP, and it's called an individualized education plan, and that's unique to special education students. Students with learning disabilities. What I would advocate right now is that we need to go with an approach, and whether we're talking about discipline or we're talking about academics, I think every child deserves an IEP, and every child deserves their own individual education plan. So if a child comes in and they're gifted in something, and they're very strong at something, and when I say gifted, I'm not saying like a little Einstein. I'm saying like work ethic. They have work ethic, they have creativity and talent. So you have to have all three, because if they're lazy and they're strong in something, that's not gifted. And I would say that child is also entitled to their own individualized education plan, where we tailor a program that is special for that child as well. So every child gets what they need in school. No child deserves the same education. Every one of us is a different individual. Every one of us has dreams and goals. There's no two people on this planet that are the same. Therefore, the education plan for every child should look different. And I can say right now, that to do that, you know, I hope that the people listening right now realize what an immense, immense amount of work that is for a teacher to make something like that happen. That's asking for a lot right there, because you're dealing with a classroom of 25 individuals right there. To make 25 individual plans and really make it happen in a classroom, that is a very, very hard undertaking for a teacher right there. And I know that from experience. So it's something that, you know, it's a reckoning that we kind of have to kind of look at as well. But teachers, for the most part, are doing so many good things, and students too. For the most part, kids are just great.
Jacob, how do you feel about standardized testing now? Is something I think you're mostly done with it.
Hopefully, I think so.
How do you feel looking back at it?
I think kind of to Mr. Albrecht's point about having to, feeling like you have to cram in to get enough material to meet the test. I, from the teachers I've spoke to and my limited experience with that, that's really difficult, because it doesn't allow for more specialized projects or passion projects or topics that the teacher might be passionate about. It doesn't allow for that extra time to teach those topics or let students explore those areas that they might be interested in that aren't covered in the standardized curriculum. So from what I've heard and my experiences, that's one of my biggest concerns with it. Maybe trying to cut back on the amount of material covered.
Sure. Bonnie also mentioned multidisciplinary teaching, and she did invoke the fact that just last week on this program, we talked about the success that Finland has had. One of the things Finland does is they don't just teach it subject by subject by subject. They teach language into science, into all kinds of other lessons, because they feel like life overlaps and these lessons can intersect. And that is an educational approach that it can be a little controversial, but it has worked pretty well there. Christopher, how do you feel about it?
Well, you know, I admittedly so. The first time I looked at this was when I got an email 2 days ago from Megan, so from the station here. So I wouldn't say that I'm an expert on what's going on in Finland. What I can say is that school needs to be a balance of student ownership and standards ownership. So you do have certain standards that you have to be proficient. You can't just say, you know, they're just not good at that, so we're just not going to do that. You have to have a certain proficiency level. So that I do agree on, and standards help us get there. And frankly, standards give us a good thing to talk about as teachers and talk about, well, how are you covering this standard versus how am I covering the standard? So we're a collaborative learning environment among teachers. So I do agree with that. However, when we talk about what's happening in Finland right now and allowing students to explore what they're interested in and go into different areas, especially at the upper grades, I think that's a great idea. The thing is, I see that as I would ask the teacher, how are you managing that? Because when you're dealing with the high school level, you could be dealing with 100 students. How are you managing this to make sure that it's rigorous? And that it is that the kids are maximizing, or their young adults are maximizing their education. That's the one question mark that I have. But I don't know enough about the system to really give you a definitive answer on it. So that would be how I would look at it. But I do like the idea of students taking ownership and having participation in creating their own curriculum. I think that's very important. Yeah.
Before the program began, Christopher Albrecht and I were talking about the fact that as part of his work as New York State Teacher of the Year, he has the opportunity to visit other schools and in some ways kind of set his own model for what it means to be Teacher of the Year. So let's get one thing out of the way here. You've got a lot of gratitude for your own administration at school, don't you?
I've got a lot of gratitude towards the city of Rochester, Brockport in general, the community of Brockport, the teachers I teach with in Brockport, the students and families of Brockport, and my administration in Brockport. I live in the town. I moved out to Brockport because I believe in what is out there. And though we're surrounded by great towns in Rochester, it's a tremendous city to raise a family. You know, I said I have 3 kids of my own. My last one's going to be graduating from high school this year. I would like to do a little bit of a shout out to Brockport. Brockport's been very lenient and allowing me to set a model of how I want to conduct myself as New York State Teacher of the Year. There are, you know, a lot of people asked, you know, what exactly is that title mean? And it's not the best teacher in the state. There are plenty of teachers out there that are doing amazing things that are just as worthy. There's thousands of them. There's 210,000 teachers in New York State. I'm sure that there are a lot of teachers with ideas that I'll never even consider in my career. So I just happen to be the one that has that recognition for this year and gets to be the representative of the state. One of the things that I found out in June that I would be the State Teacher of the Year, and I was officially named in the public's eye in September. So I had 3 months to consider it, and I decided that after kind of peeling back the onion on my core beliefs, I believe charity and service are a very large part of who I am and what I like to teach and part of my classroom, part of my pedagogy. So I've approached my school district, Dr. Myers, our superintendent, Mr. Broughton, my principal, and especially Amy Stoker, who's my teammate, and Lisa Kennedy and Diane Salisbury. They're teachers that I work with directly on my team. They've been very understanding that I've been out of the classroom a little bit, and some of it is required. I've had to attend and speak at a bunch of conferences. But what I've asked for also is when I go to conferences, I was awarded a substantial amount of money in September when I received this award. And since I'm an ambassador of education, I didn't think it was appropriate to keep any of that money. So I am going home penniless, and I've bought children's books. And I'm not just going and doing the political thing of reading in a classroom for a snapshot photo. What I'm doing is I'm going in and teaching moral lessons. And outside of Rochester, that's real easy. So I've gone up to Lake Placid or Saratoga Springs or Albany and been in different places where I've been able to speak at audiences. And since I'm staying overnight in a hotel, I have my mornings freed up. So I make my own personal arrangements. I don't have a secretary or anything. I call schools on my own, read about the schools. And I'm trying to go to schools of just a bunch of diversity, some inner city schools to rural schools, and go into the classrooms and do a lesson and then introduce a book. And then I hand out free books with the money that I received this year. The beauty of giving is sometimes when you give, other people recognize it. And I've had a bunch of people send anonymous money or named money to me to continue that program. And every cent of it is going into books. In fact, I'm probably lost money in the process of this whole thing. But what I've done is in the city of Rochester, I when I speak in the evening in Rochester, I don't get the mornings off. I still teach. So I asked Dr. Myers and my principal, may I go into the city of Rochester? And I am. In January, I'll be in the city of Rochester again, and in December, I was as well. I can say that I was pleasantly surprised. I've never been, and I wish I didn't. I will admit it, because I'm an honest person. I had a misconception of what's going on in the city of Rochester, because a lot of the news is negative coming out of the city schools of Rochester. When I went, the schools I went to, School 8, Roberto Clemente School, and School 33, John Audubon School, what I found were administrators. I found teachers that were passionate and caring, loving of their students. I found students that were in challenging situations, that you could definitely see that there is a generational poverty issue in a lot of these students' lives. I saw students that were still excited to be in school, but still had some challenges in teaching. But I saw teachers really using innovative ways. The very first classroom I set foot in was a kindergarten classroom, and this lady, what a wonderful teacher. She was sitting there. She had made it was snowing out that day, and she had made a campfire out of construction paper and had all these kids sitting around the campfire with these styrofoam balls she was calling snowballs. And as long as they sat crisscross applesauce, they were able to hold their snowball, and she was keeping their attention that way. And when I worked with those kids, it was just such a beautiful environment, and the buildings were clean. They're not falling apart. I would send my own kids to Rochester City Schools. I just think what we're dealing with in our communities right here is a separation between community and schools. I would encourage this community in Rochester, reach out to your schools. And schools, I know, after being in there, they're reaching out to the communities. Keep building those bonds right there, because you will get there. It's just a matter of time right now, but there are good things happening, and the scores don't show it, unfortunately. But from what I saw, and when I go next month, I'm going to School 3 and School 19 in January, I look forward to those visits, because it was a refreshing, enlightening experience of, you know, it shows that the scores are not necessarily representing exactly what's going on in these schools.
All things being equal, teachers who have kids who have higher and much higher levels of poverty, it's more difficult. There's more stress. Did it reflect on them? Did you see the teachers sort of weary from that?
I had heard a couple of them. Well, the honeymoon period's worn off. We call that. That's kind of a typical a term in education, that the kids are pretty well behaved the first few weeks of school, and then, you know, the true colors come out a few weeks into school and all that. They didn't, you know. I think the challenges that they're facing are not greater than the challenges we face out in Brockport. They're just different challenges. But there was one school, that's School 8. They talked about, I've looked on their website and I saw that they went from 78% attendance rate 3 years ago to 92% attendance rate. Now, that's a very significant jump right there. So when I went in there, I immediately wanted to ask their principal, what's going on here? And she mentioned the same things I always expected, you know, better community involvement, better communication, and, you know, and all those things. And I expected that. But then she said something else. She said, and an increase in the arts. And I said, an increase in the arts? And she said, oh, yes, we start our day off with a lot more art, based in music. And she said she talked a lot about a ukulele club and how the ukulele is a big deal at School 8. And I thought, what's this? And, you know, just something simple like that. That's a great outside-the-box thinking right there, but they put it at the beginning of the day. And I correlated that to a school that's sending a lot of kids to Harvard that I saw out in Vermont, which is one of the best cross-country skiing schools in the country for children, where it's an overnight. You actually stay there. It's a boarding school. But what do they start their day with? Cross-country skiing for 2 hours, which is what they're passionate about at that school. So finding what people are passionate about and putting it at the beginning of the day equates to higher attendance. It's kind of a no-brainer right there. It's almost common sense stuff, but it's funny. It's revolutionary, but common sense too. So I applaud that.
Are you bringing some ideas back with you as you go back?
As I go back to, as I talk to people, it's more that one-to-one interaction right there. But, I was in Lake Placid, and they had a chicken farm on their on their campus right there that they actually, the kids were passionate about chicken farming. And I was at another school in Saratoga. The school was completely surrounded by an apple orchard, and they actually made money for the school by using those apples right there. So I think you have to just tap into what the school and the community is passionate about, and grow, make that grow in your school. And your schools should reflect the community that they're in. That the bigger we make things, if we make national decisions about schools or state decisions about schools, we're not necessarily looking at that local aspect. We need to tap into that local, what makes people tick.
Will you come back here at the conclusion of your year and tell us
I might be opening up Pandora's box here, but if you're out there and you have an interest in education, you find me and I will do anything I can to serve what you're doing.
Christopher Albrecht is the New York State Teacher of the Year and a fourth grade teacher at the Fred W. Hill School in Brockport. 20 seconds for you, Jacob. What are you doing next? What's going on?
I'm going to be working on that PhD for the next 3 or 4 years, hopefully, so... Nose of the grindstone.
You got a big smile. I hope you enjoy it. Congratulations on all the success you've had. And I know that the Teacher of the Year wanted you here because of how impressed he has been with you. And I will share that sentiment. Thanks for taking the time to come in. I know it's a busy week, or it's usually a vacation week, so we're eating into your time. Thank you.
No, this is great. Thank you so much. It's been a real honor for Mr. Albrecht.
You got it. Jacob Gaskill is a graduate of SUNY ESF. And we will, I'm sure, hear more from him in the future. Christopher Albrecht, great having you back here. Thank you for sharing more of
your
experiences as the New York State Teacher of the Year. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Tiana Magnon helping us out today, our colleague there behind the glass. Thank you, Tiana. Megan Mack, producer of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We're back with you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.